Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by Ironman U, by EverySite.com, RunCatalina.com, Catalina Marathon coming up on Saturday, March 19th. Our Challenged Athletes Foundation, we've raised over $70 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. And you can check out any of our interviews on iTunes and on Babbittville.com. Our next guest, Adrian Haslett-Davis, is a survivor of the Boston bombings back in 2013. Not just surviving, she is actually running the Boston Marathon this year, just a few years after the bombings. Adrian, how are you?
I am doing really well, Bob. How are you doing?
I am wonderful. When I hear running and I associate that with the dancer that I know that Adrian Haslett-Davis is, how hard was it for you to go from dancer to runner?
You know, the first few miles was fine.
Yeah.
As they always say, right?
Yes, it always is.
It always is, right? It's always easy in the beginning. I had made a plea and a pledge to not only myself but to everyone that I would run, and I knew that it would happen. I didn't know when.
Yeah.
As I've told people, I'm not a runner. I'm a dancer. I could do the quick step all day long and not get winded, and I could run a mile or a block even and feel like I was going to die. So it was, I had a new kind of determination, though, once I got a blade and was able to find my stride.
Yeah.
And I put it on one day and I was like, gosh, this thing is really tricky to wear. As you would know, and a lot of people know, the blade is a lot longer than the other leg. So when you hit your stride, your hips are in alignment. And that part of it was really tricky to use. And I think it was the trickiness that I wanted to overcome. So once I was able to get a little faster and get a little faster and get a little faster, it became, oh, I'm going to overcome this. And then it became, oh, my gosh, I'm actually liking running.
Isn't that funny?
I wake up in the morning and I'm thinking, oh, I think I'll go for a run. And I'm thinking, wait, am I saying that? Then once I started doing it more and more, I just decided, you know what? I think this is my year. I think this is going to happen. So I got my runs longer and longer and really trained quietly. And then I put my name in, and I was really excited about it.
The funny thing is, I remember reading a quote from you saying, in my past life, if I was running, everybody should be running because there's a reason that I'm running.
Oh, yeah. Clearly something's wrong. Like, if you see me running, not now, but if you had seen me running before, then you should just book it because there's a very good reason. Like, something is, definitely wrong.
after something like this happens, after the bombings in Boston 2000, you're at the finish line as a spectator. When something like this happens, you think your husband is dead, you've lost your leg, it's the most traumatic thing that hopefully will ever happen in your life.
Yes.
How do you respond? It seems like your response has been, I'm not a victim, I'm a survivor, this is not going to define me, this is, my life is going to be great no matter what.
You know, I think, it didn't come naturally, but I really silenced myself in the sense, I did a lot of press, but silenced myself in the sense that I didn't seek knowledge of the events that happened. So I turned off the television, I put a note on the outside of my hospital door and my recovery door, and all of my friends and family and recovery team, doctors, nurses, et cetera, knew not to say anything. And I think that really helped my recovery. So I was focused in on what I needed to do to make it through the next hour, to make it through the next day. And that helped me look toward the future instead of looking at the past or being even more traumatized to know that the city was on lockdown. I had no idea. It's the first couple months I thought the bombs actually came from the sky.
Wow.
And I just really tuned it out. Part of that is just me, maybe denial or just not accepting it or not wanting it.
Sure.
I'm not counting that out by any means. But I think that that helped me. And looking back, I don't know if I would recommend that to everyone. Everyone has their own path, but it really helped me look forward from the get-go. And then when I was ready to intake that information, then I knew I was ready to take it in. That was after I found therapist and all of that. So I really credit my doctors and my nurses and my family and my support system that helped me getting that forward outlook from the beginning. Like, you're going to dance again. If you really want to run, you can run. If you, you know, if you want to do this, you can do this. If you want to dive and fulfill your dream of diving with sharks, you can do that too. So it was more like setting these goals for myself and working toward those goals and then absorbing the information later.
What's interesting from talking with a lot of people who've gone through, who've gone through the trauma of losing a limb or have been paralyzed, one of the things that really stuck out to me was one athlete told me that he felt he had a responsibility to all the people around him, all his loved ones, because they took their lead from him. If he was in a good mood, they were in a good mood. That he felt, you know, I can't be feeling sorry for myself because and everybody around me is going to be bummed out. How did you address that? How did you deal with all the people who obviously all they want is for you to be better and feel better?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I completely agree with that other athlete that, you know, obviously moods are contagious, as we all know, and as yes. he was explaining and you're explaining. So I definitely felt it. When I was really angry, I mean, my gosh, I would throw things, which is totally out of character for me. I'm a brush it off my back kind of person,
yes.
naturally. So it was very hard for my family and friends to see me in this state of everything, every emotion every emotion under the umbrella, right? So it was hard for me to deal with, you know, because you can try and be in a good mood for your loved ones around you, but there are times where it's going to come out of nowhere. I mean, I remember an FBI agent coming into the room wanting to ask questions. It was actually two FBI agents who I'm very dear friends with. But I threw my cell phone at them and was like I had no idea that was even coming. I guess it was stranger danger or something. But they walked in the room in normal clothes and everybody else was walking in either I've known them my entire life or B, they're the same doctors and nurses that I've always seen. Right. So these guys walked in and I just lost it. So, you know, these things can come out of nowhere. But for the most part, yeah, I felt this responsibility to be strong for them. But it was early on that one of my good friends was like, you need to let it go. You need to punch pillows. You need to, you know,
yeah,
you need to do that. And I think it's also about knowing who to call when. So we all have certain friends that will let us punch pillows and throw things and feel it all. And then we also have friends that are like, change out of your sweatpants. It's been 3 days. Like, you need to get up
off
the couch.
Put down the Ben and Jerry's.
Yes, exactly. Put down the Ben and Jerry's. We're getting out of the house, like even for a block, you know, we'll just wheel around. When I was in my chair and we'll wheel around the block, you can come back up here and change into your sweatpants, but we need to get you out of the house. So it's about knowing who to call on in those times when you need it.
So all of a sudden you're in this new world of amputees, which mm-hmm. I'm sure as an able-bodied person, maybe you had a friend or two who was an amputee, but really certainly were not immersed in the challenges that they face on a daily basis. What did you learn? What was the toughest part, the adaptation of just getting into a walking leg and handling the fact that you got one leg that's heavier than the other leg?
Yeah, so that was a huge challenge. I mean, when this happened, I didn't know a single person who was an amputee. I didn't know any of it. And none of my family did either, just by happenstance. And so I didn't know a thing. So my jaded perspective was, I'm just going to sit on the couch for the rest of my life. I don't even know what a prosthetic is. Like, I'd seen things briefly, but yeah. I didn't pay close enough attention. because it didn't affect me, right? And so, why, you know, I had this selfish outlook. And so when this happened, I thought my life was over. I mean, I was living, but I thought my life was over. And I then completely just started purposefully drowning in information on amputees and just completely immersing myself in all the knowledge and asking a billion questions and making sure that I was educating myself as much as I could. And along that route, I found out that you can't, as we all hope, just pop on the leg and go. And there's a healing process. Your nerves and bones and muscles are very angry about being cut up and sewn back together.
Yep.
And so you're swollen, you have to wait, and I hate waiting, as all athletes and most people do. My recovery was fast because I'm an athlete, but to me it was slow. Everything was slow. Even a day without a leg is slow.
Exactly.
And it's painfully slow.
When did you have the feeling that, okay, I'm starting to get this. My body is starting to adapt to this foreign object that I'm attaching to it every day.
I know the date when that happened. I'm smiling because it was extremely empowering. It was July 2nd of 2013, and I took my first steps unassisted without a walker or a crutch or a chair or someone's arm. And it was, I have to count the steps. I have it on video, but it was probably like 12 steps, but it was a big, big deal, as every amputee knows. And I was like, I think I might be able to actually walk in this. And if I can walk, I can dance, as, you know, Fred Astaire always said.
And so when were you able to dance? Because I saw a video of you dancing across the Boston finish line. I think it was Foxtrot.
Yeah. That was so incredible. I was really hesitant to dance again because I felt my limits in walking, just over cobblestones, which we all know in Boston, or, you know, stairs, or which are its own demon. I felt my limits in walking. I didn't want to feel my limits in dance. So it took me probably like a couple months after to start dancing again, even in my own living room. At home alone, I didn't even take a single dance step because it was all emotional. It wasn't physical at that point. I just couldn't do it. I just didn't want to feel that limitation. I knew I needed to, but mentally I wasn't ready.
What's hard about that is you have a vision of yourself as a dancer, as a ballroom dancer, someone who's been doing that for so long. And it's sort of like a professional athlete coming back after they're 40, 45 years old. You don't want to do it because your perception of you is different than this new you.
And I think that's something that a lot of people don't understand, is that they're like, oh, you're dancing again, that's great. And I'm thinking, you should have seen me before.
Exactly. I was great. Now I'm really good. I'm good.
And I don't want to downgrade that. You know, a lot of people, you know, don't even have access to prosthetics. I dance in a generic prosthetic for the sole reason that the high advanced prosthetics aren't covered. But at the same time, there are a lot of people who can't even do that. So I should be really grateful. But at the same time, you're thinking, gosh, just like you said, if you are a star athlete in your 20s and you try it again in your 50s, you're like, oh, you know.
It makes you hard. It makes it tough to go out and do it again. I know from working with great great runners or great triathletes and sometimes great swimmers, they get to a certain point and they go, well, I can't do what I used to do, so I don't want to do it at all because it just bums me out every time.
Yes. It's the setback. And that feeling of being bummed out, I already knew that was going to happen I knew that was going to be my first months of dancing, if not years of dancing, before I felt good about it again, and proud. Yeah. But luckily it didn't take that long. I was proud of myself early on, surprisingly, but that idea of waiting for that moment was daunting.
When something like this happens, and it's such a public venue, you become a celebrity. And you seem like you, I'm sure there was a point where it took you a while to embrace that and understand that you have a role to bring awareness to other amputees, to what amputees mm-hmm. face, to help other people realize that, hey, I never thought I would dance again. I never thought I would run again. And look what I'm doing. You can do it too. Not just amputees, but anybody who's facing a challenge in life. Was there a point, do you remember when you realized, you know what, I should embrace this and understand that I do have a role moving forward?
Yeah, it is still hard. Even to hear you say celebrity, I'm like, what? You're talking to Adrian. Like,
I'm talking to Adrian, the role model.
I don't think that's
model.
True with me.
Well, but you are a role
but,
model
no,
for
but I understand
challenges.
It. So I guess my thing is I'm still embracing it.
Yes.
But I do understand that you know, this world of amputees needs to be understood from both the perspective that I had before to people that don't know anything about amputees. There's no reason why people who have all of their limbs shouldn't understand as best they can, just like amputees should understand what their abilities are. So I love it when I can surprise someone by what amputees can do. And because I want to break that barrier between the two groups. But, you know, I don't know. I think I embraced that idea of I can really make a difference. Early on, I was in my hospital room and going through the rabbit hole of internet searches for amputees and what on earth this means for me. And I came across a blog, which I haven't been able to find since, because I was on a lot of Vicodin. but it was a girl, and it was only two entries into this blog post. It was from a long time before that. She'd clearly stopped blogging, but it said, used to be a dancer, now I'm an amputee. And my immediate thought was, oh my gosh, that's so sad. And I read it, and she talked about how her family cannot afford prosthetics. And it showed one picture of her, and she was sitting in a bed, and she was above me, amputee, and her chair was sitting next to the bed. And I thought, that's so sad that she was a dancer, and now she's an amputee. And then I was like, you know, in the slow reaction of painkillers, I thought, oh my gosh, that's me. And then I just totally lost it. And then I thought, wait, limbs aren't covered? And that was the first time I'd learned that. This was very early on. And then the next day, I was in the middle of doing an interview, and it was my second or third interview of the day. And I just, for some reason, it just popped right back in my brain, this picture of this girl who couldn't afford a leg. And I thought, if she were watching me right now, getting these limbs and, you know, having this fund and having the one fund and all of these companies reaching out, she would hate me. Like, I would be really angry and thinking, well, what about me? And so it was in that moment that I thought, there's no reason at all that I shouldn't be giving back and using this platform. And then I looked at interviews completely different. And I thought, you know, if I keep doing these, then I can make a difference for amputees in the future.
What I love is the fact that you found this blog that basically was speaking directly to you.
Yeah.
And now you can't find it.
No, I can't find it. I've looked and looked and looked, yeah. And I totally can't find it.
Twilight Zone. That's sort of the message from above. Somebody saying, hey, I'm speaking to you, but I'm going to use this other person here. But basically,
yeah.
I'm saying if you are a dancer, and you can continue to be a dancer, period. There's nothing that should hold you back.
Right, and I never wanted to find, you know, in some ways I'm glad I can't find it because I never want to find blogs like that, right? I want amputees to have legs. I think it's a human rights issue. I wear contact lenses. If I didn't have them in, I couldn't have even answered the phone.
Right.
And, you know, recently Medicare was trying to take us back to the 1970s, and if you imagine a world without contacts and glasses, I don't know what the percentage would be, but a lot of people would not even be able to get in their cars to get to work or to get to school or to get to where they needed to go. And I think that should be the same for amputees.
What's interesting to me is that's really when we started Challenge Athletes Foundation, that was the genesis, because we really started it to help a friend of ours named Jim McLaren, who was an amputee and became a quadriplegic. But after we put the one event on, just to raise money for Jimmy to buy him a vehicle, three amputee women came up to us and said, you know, Jimmy was our role model, the one who got us into sport, but did you know your health insurance covers a walking around leg or an everyday chair, but anything attached to sport is considered a luxury item, insurance doesn't cover it. And we were like, wait a second, that's ridiculous. So that's when
It is ridiculous. And it's also ridiculous, you know, when sports, to consider running as a luxury is ridiculous, or any sport, but especially running. People want to run after their kids. I mean, I think it's about perspective. You know, yes, sports, but they need to be able to run after their kids if they run in the street. And also along that side, you know, being able to stand in the shower. I remember asking for a running leg, or excuse me, a water leg, and they were like, oh, yeah, of course you want to go walking on the beach. And I said, no, perspective. Think about perspective. If I never walked on a beach again, I would be sad, but my life would go on. If I never stood in the shower, it would be defeating mentally. So I think a lot of people, you know, yes, sports are important. I'm an athlete. But I think perspective is jaded from insurance companies.
Was it hard for you in 2014 just to go anywhere near that Boston Marathon finish line? Did it bring back just horrific memories for you?
It did. Yeah, it did. You know, I am not originally from Boston. I'm from Seattle, so I didn't grow up with the marathon, but I knew the importance of it in Boston, and I knew and know that it's everyone's race.
Right.
It doesn't matter where you're from, right? So I didn't have the growing up and watching it every year, but it's more of the noises for me that are a trigger than the space. I actually live now just about four blocks from the marathon finish line, which I never thought I would do.
Yeah.
And hearing, you know, sirens from the firehouse nearby and all of those things are, it just shows how far one can come in almost 3 years. But it was difficult to go back, for sure. It's still difficult to go back. It brings back, you know, fear. It brings back anger. It brings back so much sorrow. And yet it also brings joy. I have the memory of dancing across the finish line, and that's a really happy memory. So that it's a lot of different things. And certainly after, you know, after this race, it'll mean a completely different thing again. That finish line, man, if that thing could talk, right?
Exactly.
120th running this year.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then the year in 14, you came across with your brothers?
Yes. Yes. So my brothers ran the full 26.2, not being runners, and they ran in my honor. They're my older brothers. They're like two extra dads, and they're wonderful. We're extremely close family. And I had the honor and pleasure through the Boston Athletic Association to jump in at the last block and hobble my way. I wasn't even in a blade at that point to the finish line with them. And it was incredibly emotional for the family and for all the memories that came with it. I was crying.
Sure.
They were about to pass out. I was super sweaty from doing one block. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm so tired. And they just glared at me. It was great.
That's funny. And then when you decided last year, like, hey, you know what? I sort of ran the last couple blocks, but I'm a dancer. I want to dance across. When you mentioned that to the Boston folks, what was their reaction?
You know, their reaction was go for it. That's a beautiful sign, a triumphant sign of this isn't going to define me. And it was wonderful. And it was interesting because we did it very, very early in the morning. It was probably, I want to say I had a call time of like 5:30 or 6 o'clock or something, because we're trying to not disrupt traffic as much as possible. We stopped traffic and danced, and they had these big speakers going, and my partner Shane and I danced, and we stopped traffic. And then I thought for sure, you know, it's Boston, they're all friendly, but I thought for sure we'd get a couple fingers and some honks and for holding up traffic. And people drove by and they were just tearing up and shaking hands and driving slow, and just, you know, everyone was so affected and everyone's recovering still. It was a beautiful moment. It really was.
growing up, were you a dancer? Was that your love from early on?
Very early on, yes. I grew up with parents that had a children's bookstore. They owned a children's bookstore, so obviously television was not in the picture.
Right.
And so we grew up going to the store, my brothers and I, after school, and we'd get immersed in books and poetry and all sorts of really, really fun things. And the only video that I was allowed to watch was Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, and I watched it religiously, and I saw Ginger Rogers' hair in the wind, and I declared at the age of 5 at the dinner table, I put my hands on the table, and my parents always tell the story, I put my hands on the table very I have an announcement to make kind of way, and I said at the age of 5 with my bright red glasses on, I said, I'm going to be Ginger Rogers when I grow up, and my parents said, great, that sounds great. For all the things you could say when you want to be when you grow up, but for parents that own a bookstore, Ginger Rogers isn't bad.
No.
So I held on to that dream, and I got into dance classes, and I did corporate fashion for a long time to fund my addiction for dancing, and I loved fashion. I still love fashion. It was wonderful. And then I auditioned and finally got a job with a company professionally and did it ever since.
And didn't you dance with Derek from Dancing with the Stars?
I did. Yeah, it was unbelievable. It was at he and Julianne Huff, his sister, their move live on tour in Boston, and I did not know that was going to happen. I did the package. You buy the package where you have a little meet and greet beforehand, yeah. So I got to meet them, and I was super giddy, totally starstruck, and then he came out on stage mid-show and said, there's someone in the audience who's been a real inspiration, and my dance partner was with me, and he nudged me on the shoulder, and I was like, no, no way, no way. And then he said my name, and the crowd went crazy, and I went up there, and he whispered in my ear, he's like, cha-cha? And I was like, sure. And we just started dancing. It was unbelievable.
Wow.
I was completely starstruck. And
so they didn't let you know ahead of time? It was
no,
total surprise.
No, I had no idea.
Did your partner know?
No.
He didn't know. Oh my God.
He had no idea. There was no rehearsal, no nothing. But, I mean, gosh, he's a pro. He could lead anybody, you know?
Sure.
And I'm a professional, too, even though I had my knees were completely shaking. I did wear my dance shoes just in case my partner and I wanted to go dancing after. But, yeah, it was incredible.
What have you learned about yourself through all of this?
Gosh, that's a great question. I have learned that I'm stronger than I thought I was. I've learned that I actually do have patience. I've learned, contrary to my entire life's belief, I've learned that it takes extreme grit and determination to get to where you want to go, and that it doesn't come easy, and that it's going to be painful, and that's okay. And I think that it's going to be painful and that's okay was the hardest lesson to learn. Because it is painful physically and mentally to go through, obviously, what I went through or anyone who's faced amputation in any way. It's painful and it hurts, and there are really bad days, but there are really, really good days. And there are some really, really triumphant moments, and you celebrate those triumphant moments. And those triumphant moments are not necessarily huge. They are walking up one step without touching the railing, just one step. That's huge. Walking down a platform for the first time, huge. Those are big moments that all of us took for granted before.
Is there a bond when you're at an event and all of a sudden, there is Celeste Corcoran, or there's another of the survivors from Boston. What's the relationship like with all of you who went through that tragedy?
You know, it's a strong bond. It's, as many have said, it's a club that none of us chose to be in, none of us necessarily wanted to be in, but we are, and we're so thankful for each other. There's a strong bond in many sense. You know, you can call on them and you know instantly what they've been through. And there are a lot of us, but there aren't too many of us in the sense that, you know, when you're traveling or doing something, sometimes you can feel really alone. And then you're in a room with another survivor and you hear a loud noise and you just make eye contact and you're like, I get it. You know, I get it. I'm there. I understand. I'm right there with you. Even through eye contact.
So with this, with Boston coming up, 120th Boston Marathon, and you've been at that finish line the last couple of years, but this obviously will be a little different because you're, you know, basically...
The finish line will be much further away.
Exactly.
I moved close, and now I'm going really, really far away just to get back home.
And how, what's the longest run you've done so far?
I'm now up to... I'm running in the pool also because I have a... it's good for muscle building, as we know. You need to keep that muscle strong, and it takes extra effort as an amputee. And so I'm running in the pool also, and I can do up to 13 miles in the pool, but my goal is to get to 18 before the marathon. I'm a little bit further behind than I'd like to be, but there's no reason that I'm letting up stop me.
If you're running
get there.
You're running 13, you're ready.
Thanks.
A lot of times people do too much. The key is to get to the starting line. Right, you want to be healthy getting to the starting line. A lot of people are so worried about that 18 and 20 miler that they forget that, hey, you know what? That's not the race. The race is on in April.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
There's no rush.
To be careful not to push myself.
Absolutely.
And injure myself this close to the game. You know, I want to be able to enjoy the moment and not push myself. And the Boston Athletic Association has been so helpful, and they have been. Guiding me and giving me advice on, you know, don't push yourself too hard in the beginning and it's downhill, so it's easy to just go. But you have to pace yourself. As they say, it's a marathon, not a sprint, right?
Exactly. Now, you were working Fortune 500 corporate manager. Are you still are you still doing that?
I am not. No, actually, I'm speaking all over all the time, and I'm loving that. I'm really fortunate to have started speaking pretty early on. After gaining mobility and have had word of mouth. I'm not with a bureau. I've had word of mouth and been doing quite a few speeches all over North America. So I'm really fortunate. I've done commencement speeches for Baylor School of Medicine, which graduated their first master's in prosthetics and orthotics recently. And is the first in the country of master's program.
Wow.
And which was extremely exciting to visit their school and talk to the students. I got to teach a little bit, which was very fun. And I'm doing Salem State and just schools and everything in between. Hospitals, obviously a lot with Boston Medical Center because they're my world and my love. But I'm traveling a lot and it's been really fun to meet people and to talk to other people going through really tough times, not necessarily amputation, but just when I share my story, they say my mother, brother, sister, or lover is going through XYZ, what can I do? You know, I've had people collapse in my arms and say, I haven't told anybody this, but I just got a health scare a week ago, and I don't even know how to bring it up. How do I do this?
See, and you know what's so important about that is you know, from being with CAFO over the years, I can talk to people all day long, but having someone like yourself who's gone through it is, you know, having you go to the hospital, having you speak to groups, people who are dealing with issues will approach you. You're more approachable because you've been there. That's such an important responsibility.
Well, and I don't take it lightly. You know, I was at an event in Toronto doing a few speaking gigs in Toronto recently, and there was a woman there that that collapsed in my arms, and said she's in stage 4 cancer, and she just said, you were speaking directly to me. And I've had, and then I walked and I spoke with her for a long time, and then I was walking, and a guy said, you were speaking directly to me and my wife. Like, it's really incredible. You know, I think when you're emotionally honest with people about yourself, they can be emotionally honest back, and I think that that's something that's, I know I wasn't as emotional, I didn't realize it at the time, but I wasn't as emotionally honest with myself and others as I could have been. I think that's another great lesson that I've had to learn.
What do you think the finish line is going to feel like this time around?
I'm laughing because I have absolutely no idea, but I'm smiling because I'm eager to find out. I have thought about it. I've been near it and completely lost it and just started crying out of joy and a little bit of fear.
Yeah.
And or a lot of fear, and hoping that I'll get there, and knowing the excitement and the crowd and how everybody always comes together. And you know, I think I don't know what I'll feel, but I hope I have enough. I hope I have enough hydration and oxygen to cry and run at the same time.
And the hashtag is Adrian Strong, and you're raising awareness and funds for Limbs for Life.
I am. Yes, they are an incredibly important organization to a lot of people and to myself as well. I've been with them for years. I've been their ambassador for Giving Tuesday for the past couple of years, and in 2014, a couple of my friends who ran raised money for Limbs for Life, and we're raising money for Limbs for Life, who gives limbs for life to those who can't afford them, and they have a long waiting list. And as you know how important it is to get legs, it is completely a dear joy for them to make a call and say, you're off the waiting list.
Is that the best?
You can now have dreams to dance or run or play tennis or basketball or do anything you want to do. Just go for a walk, even. I mean, how amazing would that be to get a phone call like that?
Well, and that's actually the best part of it, because it doesn't just, you give somebody a leg or a chair, you're not just changing their life. You're changing the whole family dynamics. Now
mom
can go for go dancing with the family, go ride, go on the hand cycle when the family goes out for a bike ride. It changes,
yep.
I think it changes everything.
It changes everything, and mentally too, right? I mean, it changes them in the sense that they can have hope, and they can have dreams that they can do these things, and their kids can see them, you know, walking with them and walking around the halls at their school. It's life-changing, completely life-changing.
Adrian, thank you so much for taking time to chat. I love what you're doing, and understanding that there is a responsibility for survivors to help that next group out there. I bet you, when you do speak to groups, you're sort of amazed at the response you get.
I am amazed. And people say, like, well, why are you helping out Medicare? You're not on Medicare. And I say, my gosh, the world rallied around us. They weren't blown up by terrorists. But just because I'm not affected by Medicare does not mean that I shouldn't be helping them. Like, the world rallied around us. We should be rallying around them. Like, that just makes sense to me. It's not only a responsibility, it's just the right thing to do, you know?
Exactly. Adrian, thank you so much. We will see you in Boston. I'm so excited
Bob,
to see
I'm
you.
Bob, I'm so excited. I can't wait. I will be looking for Elvis. If I have energy, we'll do a little dance.
We'll do a little Elvis dance. There you go. I'll bring the music.
It depends on where we are in the race, depending on energy levels, right?
Love
but
it.
I will be looking for you.
I love it. Adrian Haslett-Davis has been our guest. We are brought to you by IronManU, EverySite.com, RunCatalina.com, our Challenged Athletes Foundation. Check us out on iTunes and Babbittville. And don't forget the hashtag, Adrian Strong. Support Limbs for Life for Adrian. Adrian, thanks again for spending time.
Bob, thank you so much. It was such a pleasure. Thanks for talking to me, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
All right, take care.
All right, thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.